Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi guys, welcome to Adulting, and I guess I should say Happy New Year as well, because I haven't seen you since the big 2K18, and now it's 2019, which is just groundbreaking. And today I am joined by Scotty.
Hiya.
Who is unbelievably hilarious, I've already found out, because we've been just giggling already.
Oh, now you're setting like a precedent, like to be funny throughout the next 7 hours, because that's how long this will be,
right? It'll be that
final
long.
Final edit down to 7, but we'll record 24 just to be safe.
It's fine. We are literally profusely sweating opposite each other in a very swanky studio, but just dripping in sweat.
Absolutely dripping, but I think it's just adding to the atmosphere.
I agree, especially because it's freezing cold outside, but that doesn't affect us.
Do you still think we'd have to say Happy New Year to people? I mean, I actually prefer saying, do you know what? This is how quirky I am. I like to say happy birthday to people. No, I like to say Happy New Year to people in July. Okay. Just because then people think, you know, like woke people think, oh my, am I not, is this a
new, you're supposed to know.
Is this like a zodiac new year that I'm unaware of?
We should make up our own July New Year that we just pretend is a thing.
Jaleer.
So, yes, Happy Jaleer. And we'll be like, oh, it's when the world became woke to all these things and it's like the awakening of the year.
The July of 2004.
Yeah. Okay, I'm so ready for this. Wait, before we confuse everyone, do you want to tell people who you are?
No.
Okay.
No, I mean, I can. I mean, it's not obligatory. I think they should just listen. So my name is Scotty. I'm an artist. Some people call me an activist. I don't know how I feel about that. But then some big posh activist journalist wrote this thing for my book called Scotty, I Made It, which was sort of justifying the activist space that I exist in. Because I'm not one of these like political activists that goes on rallies.
Yeah.
I actually work with marginalised communities across the UK and beyond. The work that I make is often about class, fatness, queerness, survival and activism, and where those identities all intersect, and like who's not at the table, who needs to, voices need to be made louder, and how I can use arts and the arts and arts money to kind of create sort of art socialism.
I love that.
Makes me sound like I'm a nice person.
You're amazing. I know this already. The one thing I want to bring up, I don't think class as an intersect is talked about enough.
No, it's often ignored, and that's for lots of different reasons. I think when we're talking about privilege, often people who hold privileged positions feel that we are robbing them of an experience. So when we say, actually, it's more easier for you, they feel like you're personally attacking them. But what we're talking about is the demographic. We're talking about the group that person belongs to in really broad senses. And largely because the people who are at the table come from privileged backgrounds, that they can't see what it is like to live in precarity.
Yeah.
So from the age of 6 years old, I think I was very aware of my queerness and my class, and didn't have the language available to me. And so that's that my class has determined everything that has come up in my life. And so, yeah, it's often an intersect that's ignored, largely because posh people think that class isn't a thing anymore.
Yeah.
And I think often when we see class in the media and in the arts and on telly and in the radio, it's often parodied. So we see these things like Shameless, or we see things which victimise or villainise working class people like Benefit Street.
Yeah.
It's like people just trying to get away with stuff.
That's really interesting, because I'm obviously from a very privileged background. My parents don't sound like me, but I was sent to a private school. So I had no concept of class. I'll very openly say this now. I remember going to uni and watching Benefit Street and genuinely being shocked because I just wasn't brought up with it. That's mortifying to say, but it's really important to accept it.
I wouldn't say that was mortifying. I would say it's, I really appreciate that you are in a position where you can acknowledge your privilege and understand that people have different upbringings and different environments that they grew up in. I think there's a lot of people that have grown up with the privilege of education, because we have to acknowledge that education is a privilege. Massively. In this country now, that, that they can't see beyond that. And actually they become capitalist libertarians, where they just feel like actually because of the way that our government, current government, sort of DUP and Conservative have sort of curated class in by saying, if you're not trying hard enough, then it's your own fault. If you're not working hard enough, it's your own fault. That people sort of buy that. They believe that. And that's, I think, that's another reason why class, I think, isn't often put on the table.
Interesting. Have you heard of, is it Darren Loki McGarvey?
Yeah.
He wrote Poverty Safari.
Yeah.
So I haven't read it, but I was listening to him on Russell Brand's podcast, and he was talking about this as well. And he said that to him, he was like, to privileged people, you think classism is like rungs on a ladder and you're trying to work your way up. He was like, to me, class is just a parallel universe. I was existing in a working class background and I wasn't trying to get anywhere. We were just looking at each other from different sides of a road. And that's really interesting, because I would have not looked like that. I would have agreed in thinking that you would try and progress up towards being middle class, whatever, not recognising that it's not really even to do with money necessarily, it's to do with your actual conceptualisation of the world. They don't want to be middle class. Like, there's I was so far away from understanding what it really meant, truly meant to be working class, that I had no real understanding of it. And when he was talking about it on the podcast, he was saying how he thinks that one of the reasons as well that we don't talk about classes and intersect is because if we start talking about how much of an issue it is to have people in poverty, it'll mean that the economy and the rich people have to do something about money. Whereas when it's to do with like gender or race or sexuality, those things you can kind of extrapolate from the economy. You don't necessarily literally have to readdress the way that we do capitalism or whatever to fix those problems. You do, but not in their eyes.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that comes into it.
I think so. I think I've really enjoyed listening to him, and we've shared similar space, but never at the same time, where both of us have been invited to speak on quite prolific Radio 4 and Radio 3 programmes. And we're quite disruptive in those spaces. And it's interesting, like, that feels like a really natural thing for me, just to be like, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what words you're on about. You're talking about this, that, and the other. You know, when you've got like middle-class academics talking about class, always feels a little bit like, I don't know why you're here, because you've got no lived experience of it. Like, give us a working class academic, they might be able to tell us from an academic point of view and from a class point of view, a lived class point of view. I think there are things that we need to distill as well, which I think Darren does really well, which is about like the difference between class and poverty. And I grew up poor, so my awareness of class was actually about money.
Right.
But it wasn't until I came into the arts, until I came into contact with posh people when I was like 15, that I was like, oh, you mean you don't live on a flat? I remember I met this girl, Hannah, at this sort of like drama thing my mum sent me to, because it was 20p, so I went along. And also, you know, like being like a big fag, I was like, oh my God, drama, that's really fun. And then I met Hannah and she had like this amazing haircut. And I was like, oh my God, your parents let you have that hair. And she was like, you can come. And she wore DMs as well. And I was
oh
like,
my God.
Oh my God, she's so cool. I've seen people like her on the telly. You know, like, I've seen people like her on Grange Hill.
Yeah.
And then I went back to her house and it was an actual house, like three stories. And I was like, and there were stairs leading up to the house. I was just like, oh my God. Went in and she called her mum by her first name. I was just like, I'm sorry, who is that person that you've just called? And like, had someone there who cooked the meal?
Oh, I'm not that posh.
And then we sat down, don't lie. And then we sat down, and then they gave us red wine. I was 15.
Oh my God, I love it.
It was like posh Rabina. And then she was allowed to smoke in her room. And I was just like, there's too much culturally here that I don't understand.
Yeah.
And feeling like that, those first experiences of like meeting posh kids made me start to go, why didn't I have that?
Yeah.
That's your first sort of capitalist thought. Why don't I have that? Why am I not allowed to have a room that's like that?
Yeah.
And particularly because I grew up in one of the poorest and largest estates in North London. And everyone on my estate was first or second generation Irish migrant. And we all went to the Catholic school. And so you're completely in this Irish migrant bubble. And it wasn't until then going to secondary school you met other people who like... parents like picked them up in the cars, or their au pair picked them up in a car, and you were like, what the, who what? I get free buses here. But I think it's really important that we share these stories, and when we share them, that we try to share them with as much generosity, because yeah. I feel like a lot of conversations around privilege can be super loaded. Again, like people feel like you're saying you've had it easier, where of course everyone has lived traumas and experiences which like they feel shouldn't have happened to them, and rightly so. But I guess we just need to get to a place of listening. I feel we're such in a space of like defending and anger and aggression.
Yeah, I think you're completely right with that idea. I think this is where people really struggle, especially with class and race and gender issues, because you're right. We all have our own trauma, and whether that's a massive thing or a tiny thing, it's happened to you and it's all relative. So it doesn't really make a difference. It's kind of irrelevant to the point. The point is that you're at some point where you can get through doors, or you can make, like, I wouldn't have the career I have now if I wasn't from the family I'm from and didn't have the friends I'm from and had the opportunities, and the way that I was taught at school all led me to be able to do this. I don't think I'd be doing this if I didn't have those privileges. And I can see that very clearly now, which makes me a lot more grateful, makes me want to work harder. But I wouldn't have really clicked unless I'd done that digging. Because if you are in a privileged position, you're above the parapet, you don't have to look down and see what it could have been like.
Do you know, it's so refreshing to hear this, because I think so many very prolific, forward-facing Instagram folk, and I'm not saying that's what your sole identity is, but as somebody who is quite prolific on that platform, you look around and you see the other prolific faces on that platform, and they are from a similar background, yeah. from a similar upbringing. And I wonder if this is the floor of Instagram, right? Where actually that is a platform which is about people being able to show their lives and keeping up appearances. And so those who are able to keep up those appearances, or those who have got the surroundings which look aesthetically nice with a rise filter put on top of it, mean that those people can excel and succeed. So the fact that you're trying to share that privilege and to distribute and disseminate knowledge through that platform, I know you've spoken a lot on your stories about being conflicted by capitalism,
yeah.
and that platform and how you navigate that whilst being woke and also intersectional. I think that is the conversation that we need to keep on putting yeah. out there.
I think it's changing now. I've realised, because I thought the same. I was like, everyone I follow is the same as me. I'm reading the same things from white women from middle class backgrounds. And I looked out and I found actually there's loads of incredible women of colour, trans people, amazing, just doing incredible things. A lot of them artists, a lot of them working in creative industries, a lot of them with a lot smaller following than I have, for no other real reason. Why? Probably because, as I said, I'm white, middle class, cisgendered, conventionally attractive, and can... I think it runs a little bit deeper as well. The school I went to... they didn't really care what grades you got, but they brought you out to be a speaker. Everyone from my school can navigate and network a room. That is a privilege. That ability to talk in that kind of way, even have these conversations, talk smoothly, is a huge, massive privilege of education, and a very good education. Mm-hmm. And I think that's almost why... Because I remember saying, it must have been like last year when I was with an agency, and I was like, isn't it funny how everyone on YouTube and Instagram all went to like private school? And I was like, wait, no, it's not funny. That is why they're on it.
So part of my practice is I make these sort of text pieces in lots of different ways. Some of them occupy high streets. Some of them I create these big paintings. And sometimes I just leave these text pieces in public space. And one of them that I made is middle class kids are born with a sense of entitlement. Working class kids are born with a sense of inadequacy. And I think that middle class kids are raised and curated often by their parents to have confidences, to be creative, to pursue other pursuits which are less capitalist because of the afforded luxury. I, as a very poor working class migrant kid, was raised to not to assimilate and to try and earn money through like some form of means of labour, because labour equates money, and money and then equates stability. I was not raised with, but something that I bring with me wherever I go is imposter syndrome. So I know that people will judge me. As soon as I open my mouth, people will judge me on the way that I talk. And it can go two ways, right? If I'm like meeting like a big curator or a programmer for a space, I'll either soften my accent because I think they don't understand what I'm saying. Or they'll start swearing.
Oh, right. To be like more wet.
Fucking hell, yeah. God, I know how that's fucking like. Fuck. You're like, you've never said that word before, so why are you saying it now? But it's from a place of empathy. Yeah. I understand both of us are coming from a place of empathy. But yeah, that imposter syndrome that's constantly, when I make a piece of work, says to me, this is rubbish. No one's going to like it. Or if I make a big stage show, I think this is the one that they'll come and they'll say, we don't like it and I can't do this job anymore. And then I have to think about other ways of like earning a living. And so I think that sense of survival and imposter is always with me.
Yes, I definitely get imposter syndrome. And I think what's important to recognise is when we talk, because I talk about intersectionality a lot, but in case people don't necessarily understand the point of it, like feminism is fighting for equal liberation and equal rights for people.
Well, some types of feminism.
Yeah. If you're not like kind of classic white feminist. But what's interesting is like we think feminism is all about fighting for women, but I've got way more privileges than Scotty does because I'm white, cisgender, heterosexual, all those things we've talked about. Mm. Whereas you're working class, homosexual and fat, which I'm allowed to say. Because I know someone gets stressed, but we have to talk about fatness as a thing that's not a bad thing. You're just fat before someone's like, so rude. So those intersects mean that you've actually got more barriers in your pathway despite being a white man, which might get confusing. There's a nuance to it. There's different layers to things. And we have to recognise that whilst women, we all feel imposter syndrome, with intersectionality and intersectional feminism, we have to look out for the other people in our spaces that also don't get those.
True. So, this is intersectional. Yeah. So, let's just lay things out.
Go.
So, this is where I think, we need to acknowledge assumption, right? So, in this space, you've made the assumption that I'm homosexual.
Oh, yes, I was.
And that I identify as male.
But
we're both here with the right frame of, we're both coming here as in this space to be like, let's learn from each other.
I do have learning to do. Tell me.
We've all got learning to do, but this is how we've got to deal with learning. It's not to be like, no, you're wrong. I'm leaving. That was my miming footsteps outside. Actually, what we've got to do is go, oh, okay, let's have a way that we can have these conversations. Because I think Selena Thompson talks about that we're at this place at the moment where we actually are so new with theories that language often fails us. We've got to meet each other at a place of generosity, right? Because this is how we learn. And I think we don't learn from calling each other out.
Call out culture.
Yeah, because I sort of understand where it exists, where violence and aggression and extreme violences are at play. But when we're having the chat, no. So, what I was thinking there when I was on the way in here, because we're recording in Soho, and I just went past a sort of landmark for me, which is the place that I was first sort of violently assaulted by gay men. And so gay men, have always sort of found a way of ostracising me, largely because I'm effeminate and largely because I'm fat and I'm considered not to have any sexual or cultural capital by them. And to be explicit, this is white gay men and often privileged white gay men that often were very, very nasty to me. And it's outside a cafe that used to be there, a 24-hour cafe, and a whole group of these guys started to, dress me down. I was, 17, and they just started hurling abuse at me about my fatness and, really femme-shaming me as well. And I just burst into tears because there was a programme called Queer as Folk on in the 90s on Channel 4, and I used to watch it in my bedroom in secret. And I used to think, oh, this is what the gay scene will be like.
Definitely
wasn't. So I just burst into tears. And from that, I've had other white gay men try to set me on fire in nightclubs twice, actually. I've had lots of physical violence towards me from white gay men. And also, I think from about the age of six, men, white men and often white working class men who I grew up around found ways of ostracising me. When I was very young, it was just through, you're not allowed to be with us, you can't play with us, you talk like a girl, you are a girl. And then not being allowed to play with the girls because I was a boy.
So quickly, with femininity within white gay male culture is a negative, is a bad thing.
It's a bad thing because what we have to acknowledge is they are also men as well as being gay.
Still misogynistic.
So they find a way of making like a really complex misogyny. So I think Russell Tovey has quite prolifically said in an interview, which he then apologised for, that he was glad he didn't go to drama school because he didn't want to end up like a like one of those namby-pamby.
So like campness, I guess, is what we're talking about.
Campness as a cultural capital, only holds capital really in sort of straight entertainment world. So for entertainment value, because it's also camp. Sometimes campness, when it's profiled on television and stuff, not all campness, is about gay men unicizing themselves. So like becoming desexualizing and depoliticizing themselves for sort of hegemonic heterosexual cultures.
Like they'll be like the gay best friend, like the accessory. They're never like the main.
As long as you don't talk about bumming, you're totally fine.
Right, I guess because I see what you're saying because it desexualizes it in people's minds.
Totally.
So interesting.
So then gay men have adopted, through lots of really really complex reasons, have adopted this misogyny, internalized misogyny, because one of them being that for a very long time, probably since like the 30s, gay men have objectified the oppressor. So often the oppressor is like heterosexual, brutish men.
Yeah.
And so like through a lot of gay culture, there has been this adoption of what those men wore as a drag.
Right.
So like when I was growing up, like in the 90s, like lots of middle class white gay men were dressing like working class men that I grew up around, as because it holded sexual capital.
I get you.
And in the same way, like I guess in the 90s when we had, in the 80s when we had clones, so people were like wearing leather and biker stuff and that sort of extreme look of like a 70s.
Hyper-masculinity.
And so what holds sexual capital in gay male scene is the ultimate hyper-toxic male.
Right.
And so, of course, those opinions have been adopted as well. And to be femme is to be considered lower.
And I guess it's the same with women. It's like, or any like phobia or kind of like sexism, they attack you because they don't want to, that it's their fear of being associated with that kind of expression. Is that what it is?
I think so. And I think if we really want to go into the sort of sexual psychology around it, I think it's the penetrated. I think it's this idea that, and I'm not saying that all femme folk and anyone who presents camp is a bottom, as we call it in the business. But often the perception of bottoms or bottom and bottom shaming is an actual thing where you're considered to be lower.
I thought that was a really ignorant idea to think that any non-heterosexual couples play out heterosexual roles. I thought that was like a kind of like a made-up thing as well. Or is that a true thing?
No, it can be. I mean, there is, you know, there's a great quote which I love and I live by, that if you're not versatile, you're doing it wrong. And I think that, but I do think there is a replication of what we call heteronormativity or homonormativity, which is this idea that because the way that queer equality came through, and I'm talking about legislation, was through assimi gays. So the ones that wanted to assimilate. So they were like, look, we're just assimi like
gays.
You.
I love that.
We're just like you. Look, we got clean cut haircuts. We go to bed at 9 o'clock. We shop at IKEA and Habitat. We've got a little dog.
You're right.
You know, like that sort of soft white. It's the sort of Nat West version of gayness. So, of course, those who are able to see themselves reflected on a mortgage poster are white, cisgendered, able-bodied, got great teeth and hair, and they're holding hands, skipping down the road. Now, we know, because on New Year's Day in London, that in there was a physical, like very violent attack towards two queer people. So we know that advert is telling us some lies. Like, we can't just walk down the road skipping, because actually if you hold your partner's hand and they perceive you to be same-gendered, then it's always a statement, regardless of what space that you're in.
Well, do you know, you say that, and it was so, I was walking and I was in Brixton and I saw two guys holding hands and they kissed and I went, I've never seen that before in the street, ever. And I, first of all, I went, but just because I had no judgment, my body just went, oh, this isn't, look at this. And my, I had to, I make myself think about why I've thought something. And I was like, oh, I've just, like my cousin's happily married gay guy. And so I'm not, and I've got gay friends and that sounds like the worst excuse, doesn't it? But I mean, I just was shocked to see it because, not because I find it shocking, but I just registered that, oh my God, this is new, that this is happening. So that's awful that it's taken until now. Like, really, everyone should be walking around. There should be gay people everywhere snogging on the streets and holding hands, or like
people. But gay and queer people and trans people, like, we're often, I guess, less so, like when we apply intersectionality to this, so less, it's more acceptable for a gay white male couple to be affectionate in a public space because, you know, they hold privileges in other spaces. But it always, regardless of which demographic you come from, it always takes bravery. And you've always got to ask your partner. Like, I've been with partners that are just can't do that because of the fear of violence, because of violences that have happened to them in the past because of that. So, you know, we grow up in a space where we know that our love isn't normalised. And so, you know, as naff as it can be to be like, oh, there's a gay character in this soap or whatever, actually those moments, you know, some of my first moments of seeing queerness as like a working class council estate kid were through the telly. And so they do do something. But we know we're still in a space where I think people think, oh, what's left to fight for? And then you get reminded that there are these extreme violences that happen to queer and trans people across the world. Like at the moment, what's going through for the gender non-conforming and trans community and how that is being played out in terms of public space and toilet space. I mean, the violence that's enacted towards trans bodies on a day-to-day basis. I think Travis Halabanza, they've talked about a statistic which is about, I think it's like one in three trans or gender non-conforming people experience urinary tract infections because they just can't go to the toilet because they can't find public space. And so when we're talking around these things, again, we do have to apply intersectionality and be like, okay, well, we're just talking about going for a wee. We're just talking about going
and
for a wee.
And they can't even cross that barrier.
But the violence that comes towards that, and it's always women and children which are used as some form of cultural capital, which I think is really interesting that the sort of the male journalist eye will kind of push forward the male gaze as soon as it feels that it is under attack. And then it will use women as some sense of like cultural capital to
even
be like,
though they are the ones that are mostly oppressing women and children in society. Well, wholly.
And this is what I just think, like, sometimes within our feminist circles, and I use our feminist circles, like how like the anger seems to be like displaced. Like, if we want to be angry at someone, like, I know who I want to be angry at. I want to be angry at those who show me on a day-to-day basis physical and verbal violences. And I know who those people are. Those people know who those people are. And I think if we actually asked ourselves, who is our active oppressor, I think we would be able to really come together and create some form of progressive change rather than keep on squabbling about whether or not, like, trans people are people.
Yeah, but the other problem, I think, so we have the active oppressors that are blindingly obvious and everyone knows who they are, including them, but I think the dangerous ones are the ones that do all that silent oppression and they don't register that they're... the conversations they're having with their friends are transphobic, or that the things that they did to that girl that night when they were 16 is actually not consensual. I think those people are almost the more problematic ones because we all know a fascist when we see one and they're going, Heil Hitler, and everyone can go, oh, you're an arsehole. But when they are someone who says, oh, no, I'm very liberal, which is what I got a massive backlash because I put men need to do better. I'm going out with a white cisgendered guy. He's great. He wasn't offended by that because he knows in his day-to-day life he's being an ally and doing shit that he needs to do. But scores of men, my whole post had been about rape culture and women getting abused and loads of stuff like that. They all read the whole thing and the last sentence was men need to do better. The rest of it was about women being oppressed in different cultures and societies and whatever. And they all just went, oh, no, sorry, not all men. And it's like, no, you're part of the problem. Stop talking about why you're not involved in the conversation and look at the actual problem. And it always deflects back to the victim.
Oh, do you know what? I'm all about hashtag yes all men.
Yeah, me too.
Because actually...
Hashtag me too.
Because I feel that what's really interesting when you sort of put your head above the parapet and you say, this needs to be sorted out. And we can see this with something that happened very ugly, happened to Monroe Bergdorf last year, right? So she calls out white people are racist and we need to talk about white racism. Maybe it was 2 years ago now.
Yeah, I think it was a few years ago.
And was dropped from a prolific advertising campaign for that. Now, what followed was Monroe being like death threats, harassment, racism that followed. Now, if that isn't a painful demonstration of the problem, I don't know what is. Yeah. And so often in very small ways where you're then saying like men need to do better and they're like, no, we don't. It's like, let's ask why you're so defensive. But I also think that there's another group of people that I feel are the problem. And I'd like to call these people the bystanders, right? Yeah. So let's take, for instance, this story that I've mentioned. There's two queer people on New Year's Day in South Bank Centre outside National Theatre in one of the prolific, most cultural quarters of London. And it's populated often by hundreds and hundreds of people, right? There's always people there. These two people are assaulted by three men and no one does anything. No one intercepts. No one thinks this is violence towards somebody. No one wants to get involved. And it's those people that I'm like, tell me that you can walk away from that experience and say that you're an upstanding citizen. Yeah. Tell me like how many of those hundreds and hundreds of people that would have been there and witnessed that. How many of those people like to call themselves an ally? Mm. How many of those people like to call themselves an ally on their Twitter bio? Because that's what this has become.
Yeah.
We've become a culture where actually to call yourself something means that you're it. And this is why I have a difficult relationship with activism, because I don't want to call myself an activist. I just want to be activist.
This is what I find really funny, because I would never ever say I'm an activist. I'm not. I don't go out and do activist things. But people who are very, very on the really like on the outskirts of understanding what I do, they don't really, really get what feminism is. They think I'm the most ardent, raging misandrist and that I'm like the biggest activist ever. But they have no fucking clue what real activism is, giving up your entire, like the things that like, people who are activists for their job. Oh my God, it's you won't have a life. And we've lost the conversation because it has become, it's funny because it goes both ways. Like it's not good when something's a trend for the sake of it. And it's not good that people are coming into feminism being like it's trendy, like wearing a top that says feminist probably doesn't help the movement. By the same token, if it's getting the conversation out there, it's great. But you're right, it creates all these random people going, I'm in that. Yeah, no, I'm one of them. And it's like, but you're not really, because it's the same conversation with race. Like you're still complicit in structural racism if you're not calling someone out. If you're on the tube and someone's being racist to someone, you need to stand up and tell them, you know, that's not right. You shouldn't be doing that. Otherwise, you are part of the problem. And it's those silent people that, yeah, you're right, that are the real... And it's hard because you can't catch them. You can't hardly be like, it's not that you're a bad person, but you're not what you say you are either.
Totally.
So, yeah.
And I feel as well when sort of digital activism, so like people who use online space as a space to talk about activism, we need to acknowledge incompleteness and contradiction.
Yeah.
So when people are like wearing t-shirts that say, this is what a feminist looks like, and they write this big blog and they're like, this is my feminism, and everyone's like... poetry clicks, double tapping, and you're like, where's the t-shirt from?
Yeah.
Oh, is it from that high street? Okay, cool. And who made that t-shirt? And how many children died?
Yeah, I know.
Do you know what I mean? And so there's always, I want to like always ask people, particularly when we look at Pride in London. Excuse me. So Pride in London is often sponsored by a major coffee chain, right? Who say, come into our coffee shops on Pride Day looking fabulous and we will give you a free mocha chocolate, right? And the gays go wild for it. I want a skinny mocha chocolate decaf with, you know, they're like, they've got a huge rant and they're lapping it up and they're hashtagging this, that and the other. And you want to say, okay, so where do we stand with our POC brothers, sisters and siblings who are actually the people that are harvesting that coffee for absolutely no wage? Like, where do we like have those conversations just because they're doing gay for pay, right? Which is like, you know, there's something about buying the rainbow, which like they feel like we're going to harvest this pink pound by doing this thing. If they said that to me, I'd be less critical of it.
Yeah.
If like the multinational banks that sponsor Pride said to me, you know what, we're just really interested in getting some queer customers, I'd be like, fine, that's capitalism. Yeah. I know how that works.
Yes.
But buying into a protest that's supposed to be about the liberation of my community, that's why I won't be involved in it.
But this is what I hate on social media, because I think we get this a lot. Like, it happens when people start with a good intention and then realise they can monetize it, and the intention goes out the window and it just becomes all about the money. And that's where I struggle a lot of the time, because it's like, unfortunately, we do live in a capitalist society where everything is powered by this money. But you're entirely right. Like, there are, you see these people who suddenly at the face of these campaigns are doing this stuff, and it's like, you have never once in your life even put any thought into this. You don't care about this at all. And I do agree that's an issue. But then I think, but might that invite someone else to learn? You know, there's always like swings and roundabouts.
But we can mitigate incompleteness, right? So incompleteness is this idea where we understand that us as a solo entities, like by breathing and walking, by getting on public transport, by using contactless, just by like getting into the shower and using, like we are always assisting and playing a part in it. But the more we acknowledge that and we try to mitigate that, so we don't try to like... So we do try and think ethically about how we participate in those spaces.
Yeah.
That we do try and think, okay, I've done this, and so there needs to be an outcome for this, right? Yeah. So, you know, really shoddy thing is I felt very bad that I got to a position where 2 years ago I was able to leave the bedsit and council estate that I grew up on. So I was able to get a house by the seaside. Okay. So I was like, how am I going to, like, mitigate this? So I planted 5 trees.
But you know what? Listen to that. This is what is so interesting about the difference between privilege and not having as much privilege. Because someone who's really fucking privileged, because you have so much, you never even recognise like the gratefulness of having it. Whereas you've gone from like a situation which probably wasn't the best you could be in, and you felt guilt at that. And that's because you get a guilt imbued in you. When you're marginalised in any way, shape or form, you're told that everything about you is wrong, it's undeserving, it's whatever, you have that imposter syndrome. And this is, I'm going to really weirdly round this into why it's so important to educate women, because women always put, as a general, put more money back into the system than men ever do. Mm. And it's so important that we educate like women from a young age, we put money back in, because people who are marginalised generally care more about the system because they're affected by it. When you're really privileged, the people earning millions don't want to pay tax because for the life of them, they don't need the NHS or the parks or the schools or whatever else that we're paying for with the with that tax money, which absolutely kills me because I'd happily pay more tax. I think tax is amazing and we should be so proud to pay into our systems. But that's why it's so important that we acknowledge these conversations, because for you to say that and be like, oh, I felt guilt, to anyone else, that would be like, why would you feel guilty about that? But that is just an exact signal of how we treat people. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I think I felt guilt because I wondered if I was deserving of it. It's not like I got a 25-bedroom house mansion.
Yeah.
I'm living in like one of the poorest areas of Essex, in a house that like has taken like 3 years to renovate. Excuse me, which I'm like super grateful for. Like, I've got a garden, right? These are things that I dreamt as a kid to be like, what? I've got a thing called a dining room. I had to buy some tables and chairs because I didn't even have some. So there's these moments of like me awakening to, but it's also about me acknowledging like these privileges, and then sort of a really great acknowledgement of this kind of privilege that I guess I've earned is that me and my husband were talking about having kids, and then we just were like, oh my God, our kids are going to be middle class. We're like, our kids are going to be everything we hate. They're going to go to school and what do your parents do? Actually, I've got two daddies and they're both artists.
Oh, I will babysit.
So it's like...
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You know, like, I think often when we talk about class, like, there's in working class circles, there's this sense that you're a class betrayer if you, like, get yourself to a position. But I think that's everything that my grandparents and my mum came to this country for.
Yeah.
It's, like, to be able to not be, like, poverty stricken. And so, like, I don't see this as my sole achievement. I see this as my granddad, when he was 15, smuggling himself onto a cattle ship. I see that as his achievement, actually.
Yeah, I love that, because it's true. It's everything like that. It's your journey, and those privileges are exactly that. They're a format that you've been brought up in. It's all the steps that someone's already done for you, which is why it's so important when we talk about race that we recognise, especially when people say, like, demographics of people of colour more likely to commit a crime, all this conversation. It's like, that's such a flat statistic. You haven't even dug into the fact that that person's family probably went through slavery, whereas white people have got six generations of gentry behind them. Of course they're going to find it easier to get a job at Goldman Sachs. Like, you are just not thinking about it.
I think it's also about social profiling. So, you know, I walk into shops with friends of colour and then, like, we're followed around.
Yeah.
And I'm really acutely aware that, like, actually if I walk into a shop on my own, that often doesn't happen. Apart from when I was in Dublin a couple of weeks ago, and I was wearing, this is, like, really quite a bizarre thing. I was wearing a pair of tracksuit bottoms for 24 hours. I did have a shower in between.
Love it.
And three very bizarre things happened to me. I went into a nightclub, a gay nightclub, and I was removed because they didn't want people like me wearing these clothes in their nightclub. So I was removed from queer space.
Right.
Which is working class erasure, right? They're, like, making an assumption that because I'm wearing a tracksuit, I'm going to kick off. And because I wear gold rings, they think...
I love your rings. I'm just thinking about that.
Thank you. And then, so I go home, and I was like, this is really quite troubling. This is weird. But, am I surprised that this has happened in queer space? No, I'm not. I walk down the high street doing a bit of Christmas shopping, as you do in Dublin. And then I went into this really bougie department store wearing a pair of ladies' Adidas tracksuit bottoms. They look gorgy, actually, to be fair. Went in, and immediately I'm followed around by two or three, like, security. And I was like, what's going on? Because I'm, like, walking into Fendi and all of this malarkey, and I'm just, like, nosing at things, being like, how much for a handbag? Do you know what I mean?
I love that.
So I was like, oh, I'm being followed because they've profiled me as shoplifter. Because actually, if I look around here, everyone else is wearing Victoria Beckham. I don't know if they're wearing Victoria Beckham.
I get,
like,
you.
It looks beige and boring. That's what I mean by that. Is she a fan of yours? Does she listen to podcasts?
I think she is, actually. She's probably going to be quite upset. It's fine. I'll have a word with David.
Please, if you could. On many levels, if you could have a word with David. So then I'm in the shop and I'm like, okay, wow, this is interesting. This one garment has caused these two things, right? And then I come out of this department store. Oh, no, I'm wearing grey tracksuit bottoms. So I was wearing the ladies' tracksuit bottoms in the club. I'm wearing grey tracksuit bottoms in the department store. I come out of the department store, and these three guys in grey tracksuit bottoms come towards me, and they start calling me, like, faggot, you've dropped your gay card, and start trying to intimidate me. And I'm so confused by it. I just sort of say nothing on one of the most busiest high streets, like on Grafton Street. It's a very busy street in Dublin. No one says anything. And I'm suddenly left, like, in the last 24 hours, I've been, like, profiled for just one garment that I'm wearing. And it's really interesting. Like, in queer space, I'm profiled as working class and thuggish. And then when I go into the shop, I'm profiled as being, like a criminal.
Mm.
But then when I come out, the men see me and they see me for what I am, and they see me that I'm failing at masculinity in their eyes. And so I was like,
Do you know what else is stressful as well? Because right now, I'm even bad for doing this, but, like, people are appropriating that working class dress code of tracksuits and stuff. It's high fashion. Balenciaga and all these brands are bringing out, like, trainers that are, like, 5 years ago would have only been seen in, like, different areas of London that would, like, do you know what I mean? I'm getting scared about language to talk about class as well, because I don't want to say something that's
but do say it, and then I'll always say, oh, do you know what? Right, here we go. Rewind.
Yeah.
Because this is how we learn, right? We learn through each other. And by you doing this podcast, and by you, like, giving us the space to, like, talk with each other and to use the platform that you have, means that other people are learning at the same time.
Yeah.
So if we sort of, like, live in this state of fear, we're never going to progress, and we're never going to be able to see each other and see each other's experiences.
Yeah.
So I often ask people, like, don't worry. If you say something wrong, I'll go, I wouldn't say that if I was you, and this is why. And I'd hope people would do the same with me and come at it with generosity.
It's funny, though, because on my social media, weirdly, I've become very like hyper-aware of what I'm saying, because I do have a following of quite woke people, but the people that are getting annoyed at me are never the people who I'm talking about. So I might make a slip up and say something that is potentially offensive, but it's offensive on such a high level, like it's so extrapolated, it'll be like, because if you were hyper-educated, you would know that that one word might be offensive to one particular group of native people from a certain place. Do you know what I mean? The person telling me that is so privileged. And really, I'm sure that if someone from that place was listening to me talking and what I was saying, they would go, oh, she doesn't know that. Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
the people
I do.
Always calling me out are generally the people that wouldn't be offended. So I've got very clever about what language I use, and very careful and aware of how I say things, just because I've been policed so much. It's helpful, but on the other hand, in some ways, like you say, it's silencing. Because it all depends on intention, doesn't it?
I think it depends on intention, and I think it depends on the generosity in which people approach it. So recently I was making a short film for BBC Three. Hi, Mum.
Is it out? Because I haven't watched it, but I saw that.
Yeah, it's called Fat and Fabulous.
Yes.
I put a secret camera on me, and you follow me for 2 days and see how the world interacts with the fat body. And I put the camera on, step outside my house, and a policeman comes up to me and goes, what are you dressed like that for, you plonker? Okay, and so I was just like, excuse me, sorry? And he's unaware that, like, it's being filmed and stuff. And I posted something on Instagram to be like, this has happened, and the police are supposed to be there to, like, look after us.
Yeah, yeah.
And a very beautiful, tender friend, person of colour, said to me, that comes from a position of white privilege, because actually most people of colour don't feel like the police are there to look after them. They actually feel like they're there to penalise them. And I edited it. And I said, I'm keeping the main post, but I'm just going to add this little note at the bottom to say I'm really grateful for my friends of colour who've, like, enlightened me to actually seeing things I don't see. Of course, there are a bunch of white people being like, why does it always have to be about race?
Oh, so annoying.
But I left that conversation to play out.
Yeah.
Because I think it's really important that, like, as long as the language isn't violent, as long as it's productive, that we actually do learn. And so from that person saying to you, you shouldn't use that language, at least there's some contribution to thinking. But when it turns into people, like, then using personal slurs against you, people, like calling death threats against you, or, like, what we're seeing outside Parliament, people being called Nazis. Now, that, I think, is like a really weird place that we're getting in a so-called democracy.
Yeah.
And actually for us on the left, I'm assuming that you're on the left there, love.
Yeah.
like we are, like, being confronted with this idea that we have got female politicians who sit on the right who are being penalised and victimised because of some of their opinions. And actually what it's made me go is, oh yeah, democracy is about actually all of us listening, isn't it? So I think we kind of come to these this thinking all the time, but we've got to have our ears on, right?
Yeah.
Our ears on? We'll go with it.
I know what you're saying. Yeah, it's a complicated argument, because you get to the... I always try to be so diplomatic and so nuanced and always... I also will do what you do, and I will say, I've just been told... This is this. Someone once said to me that wearing hoops is cultural appropriation. I've worn hoops since the beginning of time. That's maybe me wearing something that's not from my class background as well, which is another interesting thing that people bring up.
It's a circle.
But it gets so, like... And so I just went, this is something someone said to me. I'm just going to share it with you guys. I don't know what I think, but I get nervous now to not share information. And then that turned into... I talked about it on another podcast, basically, where I talked about that fear of people kind of policing you. And then that made the conversation nicer, because it became less combative, and people realize actually we've all got to work together on this. Like, sometimes there isn't a right and a wrong, and sometimes it is contextual, and you've got to figure it out, because also the stuff we're talking about is so new. It's not the slurs and stuff. Like,
if you were to wear hoop earrings, I wouldn't walk in here and think working class appropriation. Actually,
no, but they were saying cultural appropriation from Latina culture. It was got very long, but then...
I think that's really extrapolated. Yeah. Did I just say a big word? I think that's very extrapolated.
That's class appropriation.
That is, yeah. Just use words from your own...
Do you know what? That was another lesson for me, actually, because what I used to do years ago, if someone trolled me, I would often reply with, like, an asterisk correcting their grammar. And then one day I was like, fuck no, I can't do that, because I don't know what their educational background is, and it's such a privilege of me to have good grammar. They could be dyslexic, could be anything. That was probably actually the very first lesson I had in privilege, just that really small thing, because I used to do a hat, it's your, like the twat that I am. Apostrophe R-E.
Well, at least you know you're a twat. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. You've got to be twat privilege, exactly. To be fair, my mum loves the word twat and still calls me on to this day, so that is very appropriate. But yeah, so that was like the first thing. And it does build up and you learn more. Wait a minute, I want to go back, I just remembered. Correct me about why I was made assumptions in calling you
A homosexual man. Oh, I love it when people say homosexual because it feels so vintage as well.
I know, I couldn't remember what the word was. I was like,
homosexual. So, but yeah, because of the violences, I guess, that I've experienced from both of those demographics that I talked about gay white men and white working class men, from a very early age, I realised that I obviously didn't fit in or wasn't a part of them. And so I made this piece of work called Bravado, which basically is me like exploring the things that men did to my bodies for a 10-year period. And I guess masculinity I've always felt alienated from because I'm effeminate, because I wear clothes that are marketed towards women. And that by no means says that I'm gender non-conforming or I'm trans, but when people call me a man, I do this. I go, is that... I don't think I'm one of those people. But again, I always say, like, I'm really fine with people using he, him pronouns for me. Like, that doesn't feel like a violence. But when people say, oh, a man, I always feel like, I don't know if that's true.
I get you.
I think you do know if you do feel like a man or you feel comfortable being a boy. And I was never those things. And I guess when I first came out, and I was like rumbling around Soho, I did think, oh yeah, I'm a gay, one of the gays. And very quickly I realised that culturally I was very different. The things that I wanted were very different. And I was ostracised to the lesbian and dyke scene. And I spent most of my time hanging out with the very forward-thinking, radical feminist dykes that have like completely shaped the person that I am today.
Yeah.
Because they weren't afraid of my fatness. They weren't afraid of my effeminacy. They understood that I had a huge amount of respect for women femmes. And it was a space that I felt safe in. It was my 2003 safe space before that was even a thing.
I love that because I think what I'm recognizing as we're talking and I'm realizing, and I think it's what everyone's struggling with all the conversations going on about transgender and non-conforming stuff, is the conversation surrounding gender. I feel like I'm already quite, I think, well versed, but I just registered as you're talking to me. I was like, God, I didn't even click the concept of man when I said that to you. It's such a small space to put you in, to say that you're a man. You might have a willy, I'm assuming, I don't know. And you kind of look like what I think men look like.
Yeah, because it's got a hairy face.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And short hair and whatever else. But when you're right, when we think of what a man isn't just a willy and a beard. A man is all of these cultural things and he's all of these attributes and personality traits and opinions and thoughts.
And he thinks he's a man.
Yeah, and you...
But he's also not a willy, because we have other men who don't have willies.
Yeah. But I mean, and sorry, in the context of my thought, you're right though. Yeah. And as I was listening to you, I was like, yeah, that's what we need to address to people. It's like, you can't just have two boxes and then be annoyed when people don't want to be it. Make more things then, or take away those labels. You can't expect people to fit into a very small prescription.
In the same way that we do with sexuality now, I think there's also very clumsy words around that. And of course, there's still things like bi erasure, where we don't recognise bi people, who just think they're greedy or they can't make their mind up, where it's completely untrue. Like, people can fancy both binary genders.
I almost think, sorry to interrupt you, I've come to the decision that I think everyone is basically bi, but are just so conditioned that they think they're not. This is what I'm like starting to wonder, if we didn't have social conditioning, would we all just be like, I just like... So and so.
I've made up a term.
Okay.
Just here and now, so I don't know if it's the real thing. I think we're all spectral sexual.
Oh, yes, I love that. Spectral sexual.
Get it on a this is what a spectral sexual looks like.
Oh my God, I love that.
I think in the same way that some days I feel more towards the butch end of femme, I feel some days like I've... Disclaimer, I've slept with women. It's not a horrible experience.
We are great.
honestly, but it's not one of those things. Like, so many gay men do this, like, oh, vaginas. And I'm like, that's misogyny.
Yes.
That's misogyny in action. And I totally understand preference. If people are like, I don't want to have sex with a vagina. Fine.
Yeah.
Totally fine. But you don't need to say, oh, vaginas are disgusting. It's just, I just don't want to.
Yeah.
But emotionally, I connect with butch people and mask people more than I do on like a... Actually, that's a lie. I think I get on different planes with femininity than I do with masculinity. And there's a... Oh, God. Here is the massive head fuck, right? I prefer always the company of femmes and women. I feel safe. I feel like there's a mutuality. We can talk. Like, I feel like I'm part of a gang. I feel like I'm there. I feel solid, right? Men, when I leave this space, there'll be men shouting things at me. They'll look at me. They look at me like I fail masculinity. And so because of their bravado, they feel like they have to shout it from vans. They have to tell me. They have to take pictures of me in public space to let me know, right? So I end up hating a lot of men. And I'm all right saying that aloud. I end up thinking, you are going to do something to me. You're horrible. You're nasty. But I also want to sleep with them.
Babe, this is my day-to-day life.
Oh, it's so disappointing. I feel so disappointed with myself to be like, oh, God, why love thy oppressor?
But no, but it is that. And I think it's because we're conditioned to believe that those traits are attractive, like we spoke about before. So all the things that are fundamentally like dangerous to you, you've also been told are what you should be looking for in a mate. So literally I'm exactly the same.
And I can sit in here with you for an hour and talk about like this, that and the other, intersectionality, gender, da-da-da. And then as soon as I see a very attractive man, I will just be like, I'm a bit gayer. And like all of my identity is completely full because I want to try and make myself the most attractive. And it's so bizarre.
But I do this too. And actually, someone said this to me once. My boyfriend is really conventionally attractive. He is fucking hot.
He is, correct.
And people message me a lot being like, you're really feminist, but your boyfriend's really good looking. As if those two things are mutually exclusive. So first of all, either they're saying I'm punching, which is fucking annoying, or they're saying that if you're opinionated, you can't possibly catch one of these good-looking men. He's actually really... Can you not ask me, is he as feminist or as clever as you? Don't ask me. You're not quite as good-looking, and also you open your mouth a lot, which he likes, I take it. Sorry, Mark.
I really love the idea that people, like, victimise you because they're like, you're feminist, you must have an ugly partner.
Yes, exactly.
Or be a lesbian, please. Like, as if those are the only options, modes available to you. I'm trying to think what I thought when I first saw your boyfriend. I thought, delish.
So delish.
And then I thought, well done. Well done. Well done you, actually, for finding a nice one.
Yeah, he is. It's very good.
Yeah. Great skin. Well done. Actually, one thing that disgusted me about you was both of your skin was grey. And I was like,
oh, sorry.
Oh, do you know what? It would be really nice if there was like a pimple or just something that made me go, can relate.
No, but his skin is annoyingly good. And actually, sometimes I'm like, you are too good looking. It's just annoying. Don't look at me.
Do you know what? Confession.
Go.
I only really fancy two good looking people because I really love... I love the chase.
Oh, yeah, always.
Right. But something that I really love is introducing partners to people that don't really know me. So, like...
Oh, to, like, see what they...
To new people.
Yeah, whatever. I love it.
So people will meet me and they'll think, oh, my God, you're great, okay. And I'll be like, oh, I'm going to bring a partner along to this event that's happening tomorrow. And it's happened so many times where the partner turns up and they go, oh, hello. And then you can see in their mind, they're like, I was expecting someone fat and ugly.
Oh, my God.
I was expecting Scotty. This person, has this person seen you?
Okay. No, but just because, first of all, one, you're really attractive. We need to stop making fatness a thing that means you're automatically less attractive. Mm-hmm. I just think you're really attractive, so it wouldn't surprise me. Maybe I'm just fucking cool. that you're fat.
You're just woke. Fat woke.
Fucking woke.
No, fat woke.
Oh, fat woke. Woke. Okay, fine. Thank Love you. That. Get that on a t-shirt too. Yeah, and I think that
skinny people are real people too.
Yeah, I know. God, we have to. I do get that a bit when people get annoyed about people not speaking up for skinny people. Moment of silence for them. but yeah, and I think it's so funny that when we think about attractiveness as well, it's like, how are you... But this is also the problem. We're sold an image that, like, what you should look for is exactly what they are. I think I'm attractive because I'm clever. I think it's the coolest thing about me. And it irritates me that you're not validating that. Can you validate me for that, please?
You're clever.
I fucking hope so. You're good that I've said it, wouldn't it?
Let's put it to the Instagram vote.
No. I've completely lost my train of thought. Oh, yeah. Can we talk about, actually, relationships? You're married.
I am.
Tell me about that.
So I met the person that I'm married to or married with. I'm trying to decolonize language around relationships, because I think I'm heading towards this space of relationship anarchy, which, like, is a whole nother podcast, right? I'll come in for another 2 hours at a different point, and then we can talk about relationship anarchy. And there's so much the way that we talk about partners, where we say my partner, my boyfriend, my husband, we're
so
married.
True.
That I'm trying to, like, and, you know, in the same way that we use ableist language, I'm trying to be like, I've said that thing again and I need to correct myself. So I am married with a person.
Okay.
Is that the right way? Yeah, we are with each other. We are partnered. And we've been with each other for almost 15 years, which in gay years is like dog years.
But that's forever anyway.
Honestly, you say that to like gay and queer
friends. That's most of my life, babe.
How old are you?
24.
Oh, get in the bin. 24 and woke. It's so disappointing.
Yeah, but look how good your skin is. How old are you? You've got not a wrinkle in sight.
34 this year.
Oh, that is really young still, so you're fine. You don't have to get wrinkles.
No, yeah. You should have said no. The correct response there is, oh my God, 34 is still no wrinkles. You look great.
Oh yeah, that is what I meant. It just came out weirdly worded.
Fatness preserves. No,
I've thought this through. Yeah. I'm going to get fatter when I'm older. My face is already
fat
quite round.
Fat appropriation now.
Sorry, fucking hell. But it makes you look younger.
But also you have to be interesting to be fat. So there is a test.
Oh, okay.
Which me and Sophie Hagen could do for you.
Okay, yeah, yes, please.
There's a sort of test.
To see if I'm allowed to enter.
Initiation ceremony. And then we put it to the fat vote. It's a bit like going through to judges' houses on X
Factor. Oh my God, I'm so excited.
Yeah, you might not get through, disclaimer. Okay. You might be evicted. We might come to a deadlock. We might have to go to a people's vote. There might be a referendum.
Okay.
Just saying all those things.
I don't think I can deal with any more referendums, but apart from that, we'll survive.
So yeah, we've been partnered for 15 years. And yeah, it's like, it's joyous, because people are often, like friends of ours who are queer particularly, often look towards our relationship as this form of success. Mm. And they're like, why don't I have it? I want it. And it's like, well, you need to accept that you'll hate each other at periods of time.
Yeah.
And you'll majorly disappoint each other. And it's not going to be a Disney film. And I think too much about love and partnering is about these perceptions that are put upon us from films.
Yeah.
Like, oh, sorry, what, you don't like cheese? In which case, not going on a second date with you. And you're like, it's really okay that you don't like aspects of each other. And there have been moments where, with James, that I've been like, disappointed in him. And there have been moments where he's been disappointing with me. But you acknowledge that you will disappoint each other at periods in your life, and that's all right.
I think what I'm starting to learn is that what we're sold is that you'll meet someone and then you'll be happy. No, I need to be happy on my own. And then if I'm happy, I can be happy in a relationship. But I'm not going to get someone to add to my life to try and, like, fill me up. Do you know what I mean?
I don't know. I disagree.
Do you?
Oh, well, when I met James, I think I was a deeply unhappy person.
Oh, so he helped.
And I think we both helped each other understand. And also we give each other the space to change. So the person that I was 15 years ago is not by any means the person that I am today.
Yes.
And so giving each other that space to adapt and change and develop with each other or without each other.
But exactly. So you're not codependent on each other is what I mean.
Yes.
Whereas I think you're sold, especially as a woman, that like your life is fine, but when you meet a man, then you, well done.
Validated.
Whereas I want to be like, maybe that is me rebelling a little bit from that narrative personally, being like, actually, no, I would be fine on my own, but Matt's a fab addition and he's amazing, but I don't need, he's not necessary to my story. Does that make sense?
That totally makes sense, yeah. I mean, you know, it's part of a very radical feminist thought of thinking, like, do we need masculinity to validate us? And I think there's some theory around triangulation about how often we can hold these positions. So there's ourself, there's the political self, and that political self can exist in its radical form about being, I'm a radical feminist or this, because there is still a man present. And so, yeah, I think it's really good to try and find ways of decolonizing that. I'm reading a book at the moment that a partner gave me called, I can't even say what it is, it's so like clever, Xenofeminist?
Oh, I don't know.
Xenofeminist. something. Oh, it's in the bag. Well,
I know that xenophobic means a fear of foreigners, doesn't it?
Well, it's not that. It's not a fear of foreigners.
No, but is the xeno bit, does that mean foreign then?
I don't think, maybe I've just said it wrong. It's cool.
I could have made that up also. So.
The Xenofeminist Manifesto? Or what does that word say?
Yeah, that must be xenofeminist. Tell me about it.
No, this is a book that I've only got to page 28 and I've been trying to read it for a month because, like, look, the opening gambit is biology, but I can't even say it. Here we go. Teeth in. Ready. Comprehend this. Biology is not destiny.
Oh, so it's saying that the nature versus nurture argument. So it's like your nature isn't what you have to be.
But is it?
No, I don't think it's a bit of both.
So it's got these like really beautiful thoughts in it where I'm just like, okay, I need to reread this page again. And I am up to page 29. And
I love
I'm just,
that though.
But it's about looking at feminism through the gauze of intersectionality, gender awareness, and non-biology, and going beyond this idea that capitalism will always be present.
I can't even imagine. I try and imagine the world without capitalism and you, like, can't. You get one step and you're like, oh, yeah, there it is.
Because what else?
I don't know.
Yeah, me either.
Unless we just... if we looked after land, I was thinking this, we wouldn't work and we just looked after the world and didn't kill everything. We could just live off the land, but everyone would have to die because there's too many of us.
There are too many of us. I often think that we are the problem.
Oh, we are. No, we are the problem, yeah. 100%.
And people, like, because some of my work exists in this idea of looking at intersectional ecology. And so I've written papers, look at me, a pseudo-academic in the corner. Last day I went to school, I was 14. So, I mean, definitely not an academic.
Yeah, but we need to separate that idea of, like, institutionalised education from what it means to be academic or intelligent, because they are not the same.
This is a random plot. Where was I? Sorry, I was talking about xenofeminism.
Yeah.
no, I can't remember what I was talking about.
And your essay. And your...
Oh, yeah. So I look at intersectional ecology and how, like, it's actually easier to be an eco-warrior if you're posh because you can afford the 250 extra that eco-v is going to cost you per bottle or whatever. And within that thought, I often say things like, people ask me questions like, okay, so what's the future? How do we do it? And I'm like... Get rid of ourselves, delete us, let it just like regrow and do something.
I often think that by the time humanity works out how to fix all of our flaws, it'll literally, someone will go, oh, I've got it, and it'll just explode. I literally think that's how long it'll take, millions of years.
Yeah, because we've been talking about identity politics for a very long time now, and actually we need to accelerate the speed in which we're talking about it and become a bit more radical and ecologically minded when we're talking about this type of stuff, because time is running out.
Yeah.
And like it's not like someone in a tinfoil hat is saying, the world is going to end. Like, people who have like got big letters after their name, who've dedicated all their lives to it, going, probably got about 20 years till it gets a bit hot.
Yeah, but I think we were, I think we go cyclically. So we've seen, or we've had...
That means in a circle.
Yeah, but like move forwards. So we take 100 steps back and then we go all back again and then forwards, because we've had these conversations before around gender, around sexuality. They've happened. And now we're just going, oh, we'll have just a little bit of revision, go back, oppress, and oh, go 20 years forward again. I feel that's what, like, happens.
Well, because conservatism, in many forms of that word, takes hold.
Yeah.
Because people get frightened. I think the clue is we need to all be having it off with each other.
Agreed.
And I think, like, commune culture, and when we're looking at, like, how people shared space and living space, particularly adopting some of the thoughts of, like, polyamory, queerness and relationship anarchy, and applying those to, like, socialism and how we might live in the future off the land with each other, coexisting, meeting everybody as an energy. And now I sound like I'm the Tim Thorne
person. No, I'm into energies now.
But I think, like, some of that radical thought could hold the devices of how we move forward.
Yeah, I agree. And also, because we're so individualised, social media causes this problem as well, but there is no sense of community. We've completely lost that. And that's, like, we have a minister for loneliness. Apparently, like, if you're lonely, it's just as bad as smoking 15 cigarettes a day for your health. And we're creating these new paradigms of what it is to be unhealthy. We're getting so healthy on the one sense. All of us are going to the gym and exercising loads. But our mental health and all those other zones that we could be tuning into, we're completely losing.
So much to break down there. So let's break this down. Pause. Okay. not all of us are going to the gym. Okay. And then there's this.
Sorry.
Just want to put that out there. Some of us are doing half an hour of yoga in the morning.
That's amazing.
I love doing yoga. And fat yoga at that as well, because you've got to adapt some of the moves. Yeah. Because, like, there are other body parts in the way.
Yeah.
No one's ever told you about that. Then the other point was...
social media.
No, you said something else. It was really important.
Oh, I always do.
Yeah. if the last hour is anything to go by.
Oh, that we're losing our mental health.
Loneliness. So not all of us are going to the gym. Pow, pow, pow. Number two is that I made a piece in response to loneliness, right? And where I got a whole street, I worked with a whole street and said, I want you to nominate yourself as the loneliest street in Leeds. Then the street came forward and it felt like the right street to work with. The project was called Would Like to Meet. And I put out these estate agent signs outside everybody's house about the type of people they would like to meet. And then I dared them to talk to other people that they shared similarities or hobbies or pastimes with. And then I was asked this question about the loneliness minister. I'm like, well, we've got a loneliness minister now, right? So, of course, like, we're trying to tackle this. I'm like, this is incompleteness in its, like, beautiful sense, right? So we have a minister now in place to tackle loneliness, who is part of a government who has done everything possible to decommunicize our communities, to strip back as much as possible from the public purse so that there are no access to libraries, public space, community centres, that this thing that... Do you remember this person called David Cameron? Do you remember him? Did this thing called Big Society, which is essentially him going, we're not going to pay for it anymore. You'll just make it up in your head. It'll be a concept. You'll just sort of go out and look after each other, and this is how the government's going to look after you because I've called it something. So we've got, this is what I'm talking about, like, major incompleteness. Mm. It's like one hand is doing one thing and the other hand saying, no, but it's fine, we're tackling it. And I think those are the where I see my activism's lying, where I want to be looking at those, that sort of detail. Because if you try and solve that one thing, if we try and get people talking to each other, we try and get, like, this happening, what I think, like, really brilliant thinking happens. I mean, people who listen to this might think otherwise. They think, maybe they haven't even got to this bit. They're like, oh, this is boring.
No, we're brilliant. We'll be fine.
No, I am. I'm great.
Yeah, you are.
I really like you on the internet.
Oh, thank you.
Sorry. That also sounded like I meant, like, but not in real life.
How am I doing in real life? What are your thoughts and feelings? Better online? Catfish, slightly.
No, you're better in real life.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, you should put more of that on the internet.
I just bottle it up and put it on. Thank you so much. What were we saying? Oh, yeah, no, one quickly. You're right. Everything in life, this is such a good example of that, where we see something, so we think it's being fixed. It's like with the Minister of Loneliness. It's a bit like when Barack Obama was president, so they were like, oh, we've got no racism in America now because we've got a black president.
A president who had to have works. £26 million security budget.
Yeah. So that doesn't work. You're right. And we have to look deeper than the surface, but everyone's so busy working because of this capitalist world. Like, people just don't stop working. It's fucked, basically, isn't it? This is what happens when I do the podcast. You get, like, meet a great person and then just feel a bit depressed.
Yeah, but I mean, what we'll do is we'll go away and we'll think about it, and then maybe I'll slide into your DMs and think, oh, I think I've worked something out.
Yes.
This, and we come up with ideas and devices, and other people that are listening to this might go, do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go out and I'm going to talk to someone. Or they might think, do you know what? I'm going to start calling that person fat. Or they might think, do you know what? I'm not going to make the assumption that everyone goes to the gym. do you know what I mean? Like, this is through that, these, like, little things happen.
Yeah.
And that's all we can hope for, is the little things happen. And often when I'm making a piece of work, I have these big dinner debates where I invite people in. Oh, I order a takeaway and we talk at speed until the takeaway arrives, and then we all eat with each other.
Oh, that sounds like a dream.
Because I think we're most democratic at the moment when there's food on the table, because it's like you've been invited to my house for tea, and we all know how to behave regardless of what social strata we're from. We all sort of know how to behave when you've been invited somewhere and then there's food on the table. Oh, I've lost my train of thought again. But I was going to say, often in that space, what I do is I always start the conversation by going, lower your expectations. Like, if you're here because you think something's going to be solved, if you think we're going to solve disparity in any sense, soz.
Yeah.
And all
sauce. I can't even say it, but sauce.
Not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Like, you and I have a conversation. It's brilliant. It's gorgeous. It's lovely. You've got wonderful eyelashes. We've stopped sweating. We both
well, you might have. I'm still going strong.
But nothing here's solved.
No.
It's the work that comes after that
yeah.
that actually starts to create some form of shift and change. And there's a really brilliant book called How to Change the World, right? And that has taught me about ancestral activism. Mm. So everything that we do now, we shouldn't be invested for it to be for the self. It's not for us. It's going to have a ripple effect that will create some form of change for the next generation. And to approach activism and conversations and politic in that way, I think decentralizes that capitalist thought of me, I, yes. me. And that is possibly what I want my epitaph to be.
That is amazing. I literally think that's the best thing I've ever heard. And that makes so much sense to take it away from the you and put it into the future. Because that's what we're lacking now. That's why the environment's fucked.
Yeah,
because we only think about that 5 minutes ahead of our own time.
And it's why a lot of those Brexiteers voted in the way that they
yeah,
did.
Yeah, 100%. Well, I'm going to let you go because I know you've got to go get your lunch.
Please. I mean, it has been 9 hours.
I know, I've locked him in here and everything. Thank you so much for giving me your time. I've absolutely loved it. And if other people want to come and find you, follow you, tell us where you are.
I'm across the internet as Scotty is Fat, and that's Scotty with two E's. But yeah, I mean, if you put in Mouthy Fat Gobshite on the internet, I'm probably up there quite high.
How pissed off would you be if someone else is at the top?
I think Sophie Hager was probably just slightly higher than yeah, the maybe. Mouthy Fat Gobshites. But maybe if you put in Mouthy Fat Gobshites with... No, Sophie still wins.
Oh.
Yeah. I think I just... I sometimes I meet people and I'm like, where do I recognise you from? I'm like, it could be, like, from the internet or it could be from the chip shop.
Yeah, we just don't know.
Who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows?
Amazing. I've really enjoyed this.
I have thought this was okay.
Okay. Thank you so much.
This has been...
I get really sincere at the end. Does it creep you out?
Not in the slightest.
Okay, good.
No, because you're dead behind the eyes, so... You're not. You're not. These are all things I'm saying for comic effect.
I'm really enjoying them. Thank you so much. Thank you very much for listening, guys, and I hope that you do go and find Scotty online, because he's a ledge. Why did I say that? A better word. A ledge is horrible.
I'm leaving.
He's a fantastic human. We'll see you soon. Bye. Are you going to say bye?
Oh. bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.